Hello there.
Tonight, I again proudly accept that nomination for President of the United States.
I have a bad feeling about this.
But when the President does it, that means that it is not illegal.
What?
Welcome to The Joy of Star Wars. I'm Simon, and with me as always are the Grogu and Mando of Star Wars podcasting, Vaughn and Steele. Hi, guys.
Hi, Simon.
Hello. Which one's which?
Rude.
So, Vaughn, who Rude. Do you think you are out of those two?
Obviously, I'm Grogu. Don't even. Steele, you have, you have like, Mandalorian armor. Like, don't even. And I'm a sleeping
baby. Yeah, but I thought you were Pedro Pascal, though.
I mean,
don't you want to be Pedro Pascal?
Obviously, but I know that I'm not. I know my limitations.
That's true. That's fair. Yeah.
Right. Yes, I knew that would get you both. Excellent. Today we are joined by the fourth and probably most popular member of this podcast family, our very own quizmaster, and making his first appearance on the show, our wonderful friend Daniel. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me on.
It's a pleasure to have you on. And this is a bit of a special episode because I believe it's sort of been concocted between the two of you, both Vaughn and Daniel have kind of come up with this episode, which I don't really know anything about. So Vaughn, do you want to introduce what this episode is about?
Yes, I do. And it was concocted between the two of us, absolutely. So we are going to do things a bit differently. I'm going to present my historical argument, and our wonderful Daniel is going to present the main Star Wars underpinnings of that theory. And the topic today is around class dynamics and urbanism. What do you two, Simon and Steele, think that means? Where are we going with that?
So you did prepare me for watching 4 episodes of Clone Wars ahead of this. So that just you saying those words out loud does make sense in that the episodes that I watched kind of play into
your
that
homework.
Theme. Yeah, the homework that you gave me did play into that theme about the divide between some people who get special treatment in the Star Wars universe, be that by the gods of the creators or be that by the economic standards in which they live. And then other people are sort of down in the gutters or don't even know what an academy is. You know, they couldn't understand or name what a Skywalker Academy is, even if they heard it. So, I guess my initial impression is that there is so much of what Star Wars is about, at least what I think Star Wars is about, is a sense of, when we say sort of good guys versus bad guys, it's not just drawn in that kind of black and white terms of like everybody on the good side or everybody on the bad side kind of have equal footing within that establishment. There is so many people who are, you know, struggling to get by and who are shades of grey in these types of things. And I guess my initial reaction to that is just wanting to explore some of the stuff that I'm already interested in when it comes to Star Wars and how it relates to inequality and the gaps within society and the people who are left behind and marginalized.
Excellent answer, Simon. What about you, Steele?
Well, you did tell me what we were going to be talking about. So, I'm going to guess that we're talking about Coruscant and the divide between the undercity and the overcity of Coruscant, because Coruscant is thousands of levels, and it goes all the way down to level zero, but finding out that the deepest that people go to is level 5, thanks to a comic that I read today as homework from Dan. And they don't spend a lot of time they spend no time at all in the films really looking in the Undercity. There was going to be a video game called 1313, which was cancelled, which was going to be set in the underbelly of Coruscant, and they've brought it in the Clone Wars and things like that. but it's still, there's a lot of territory that they haven't really approached. I really liked seeing it in Andor. When Stellan Skarsgård has his monologue, you see a lot of his trip down to the Undercity, and it's really cool. And obviously comparing that to modern like political parallels, which we're going to talk about, which I wasn't sure about until you told me about it earlier, and I was like, oh, okay, that's a thing. So I'm going in pretty dry on this one. So,
all right, yes. So, yeah, I spoiled it. We are talking about Coruscant. And if Simon had paid attention to his homework of the 4 episodes of Clone Wars, he would have been able to say that as well. But he did not pay attention, evidently. Those 4 episodes were from season 7.
I did pay attention. Just because I can't always name gibbledygobbledy city doesn't necessarily mean I didn't pay attention to the episode.
No,
gibbledygob city is on Ord Mantell. Thank you very much.
Oh, okay.
So, yes, we are talking about Coruscant and class dynamics and urbanism. Let's start off by narrowing it down more. So the galaxy is a massive sample, and class dynamics in Star Wars could be an entire podcast unto itself. So what we are going to do for this episode is look at one aspect of class dynamics, being the strain between urbanism and suburbs, particularly between wealthy elites and poorer working class individuals. And naturally, this makes me think of Coruscant and the inhabitants of the upper and lower levels. And as correlated to American history, it makes me think of major US cities such as Washington, DC. So let's take DC as our primary example for this history. The District of Columbia, so named in honor of Christopher Columbus, which we don't talk about enough. that was founded in 1790 and has served as the nation's capital ever since. DC sits on Nacochenked lands and is not a state. The district is therefore directly under the control of Congress as their executive legislative branch, and it was not until the 1973 District of Columbia Home Rule Act that DC residents were allowed to elect a mayor and city council. DC is currently continuing a multi-decade campaign for statehood that would allow them representation in the national government and sovereignty over their own communities, which they very much deserve. For all intents and purposes, the area of DC is largely inhabited by the city of Washington. When you think of DC, you probably think of the memorials and White House, Capitol Building, the iconic sites. But you might not know that the population is just over 700,000, with an estimated 1 million people daily in the city due to suburban commuters. Nearly 4,500 of these residents were reported homeless in the Department of Housing and Urban Development's 2022 report. The demographics of the city, according to the Census Bureau in 2022, were 45.9% white, 45.8% black, with far smaller percentages of other races and ethnicities accounted for. This is significant both historically and at present. Historically, many U.S. cities with higher percentages of black residents have had demographic changes over time, especially during the Reconstruction period and the phenomenon called the Great Migration. D.C., however, was and is the nation's capital, and our founding fathers were enslavers who brought their enslaved people to the area with them. It should be noted that not every African American in D.C. was enslaved. By 1800, about 25% of the population were black people, the majority of whom were enslaved. The area outlawed slave auctions in 1850, and every enslaved person in D.C. was declared emancipated in 1862. During this time, the abolitionist movement in D.C. was led by black activists cultivating communities in the city limits by establishing churches, schools, and societies. By the 1970s, the black population in D.C. was 70% of the total population, but this has since been in steady decline as gentrification movements have priced many in the lower income communities out of the area. Now, here is the crux of the issues I want to talk about. In D.C., according to the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute, white households have 81 times the wealth of black households as of 2022. This district has little sovereignty, only a city council and a mayor, and is functionally executively legislated by a federal body in which they have no representatives, while the demographics of the city have drastic wealth inequality by design. In the last 20 years, D.C. had an illiteracy rate high of nearly a third of residents in 2007 and a high of 19% of residents under the already lowballed poverty line in 2005. These numbers have lowered somewhat since then due to gentrification and an influx of wealthier white people over the last 10 years, pushing poorer residents out of the city and into the suburbs. This phenomenon of gentrification is a reversal of the mid-century move to the suburbs, commonly referred to as white flight. In most major American cities, as the immigration rates increased in cities and population density meant wealthier white inhabitants of those cities had to mix socially with other communities, the development of suburban areas in the post-war period and nuclear age of the 1950s drew many of these urbanites to the suburbs. This was coupled with the increase of affordable cars and public transportation networks, such as commuter rails, making it easier for people to live in suburbs and work in city centers, but not have to socially mix with any other communities they felt racial or class-related discrimination towards. This white flight also exacerbated many social and cultural issues in the U.S., including property tax and public schooling funding, resulting in a systemic and structural design of keeping the inner cities, where many people of color lived, underfunded, undereducated, and underserved by their state governments. In D.C.'s case, this was worsened even further by not having a state government for support or a representative body anywhere until 1973, when they were allowed their city council and mayor. Gentrification is flipping the white flight in a similarly problematic way with regard to social and cultural issues. In practice, gentrification is the influx of more affluent, wealthier residents who alter the demographic and cultural makeup of a neighborhood and ultimately also the social makeup of it. Gentrification, this return of wealthy white people to inner cities that their older generations abandoned for fear of racial mixing, started as a trend in the late 1990s and has grown more powerfully destructive and widely practiced ever since. To a degree, local investment in a community is good when it is enhancing the community of long-term inhabitants, established small businesses, or encouraging new ones from those local inhabitants to stimulate the local economy and help the inhabitants thrive. Thriving local businesses can raise property taxes and in turn better fund schools and other local resources. However, gentrification frequently goes too far in that direction of bringing new people into a community for its aesthetic or low rent prices, establishing their businesses, renovating existing buildings or commissioning new buildings, raising the property value out of control of the established long-term residents, and completely changing the social, cultural, and economic makeup of the area. This is a very real problem faced by the people of D.C. who are being pushed out of their own city, where they have cultural roots and historical communities established over literal centuries in the area. Now I'm going to turn this over to Daniel for how all of this relates to Star Wars.
Thank you, Vaughn. Coruscant, or something resembling it, has been a part of Star Wars since the beginning. Plans for visiting the capital of the galaxy existed in the very first treatment of Star Wars, though it was known as Alderaan at the time. The idea would again be revisited when developing Return of the Jedi, with a planet now called Had Abaddon, and for the first time the idea of an Ecumenopolis, or planet-wide city, is introduced. Ultimately, this is the very reason it doesn't make it into the final film, as technical limitations meant this was impossible to achieve. In 1991, Coruscant is named as such for the first time, in Timothy Zahn's seminal book, Heir to the Empire. though curiously it isn't quite the Ecumenopolis we'd expect, with forests and mountain ranges featuring alongside sprawling cities. Nonetheless, it doesn't take long for depictions to start matching its modern appearance. And in 1994, the underworld of Coruscant first appears in the book The Courtship of Princess Leia. A year later, we get our most detailed look at the capital so far in The Illustrated Star Wars Universe, which introduces us to locations like Monument Plaza, the only location on the planet where you can see the surface of the planet itself, namely the peak of its highest mountain, Umate. Coruscant appears on screen for the very first time in the 1997 special edition of Return of the Jedi, where we briefly see citizens celebrating the destruction of the second Death Star at Monument Plaza, and 2 years later, with the release of The Phantom Menace, the planet at last takes centre stage, solidifying our current depiction of the planet. Coruscant has always been a deeply divided city. Take these two contrasting quotes from The Illustrated Star Wars Universe. So, firstly about the higher levels. The rooftop of virtually any building offers a truly breathtaking view unparalleled on any other world. Towering skyscrapers, built of transparent steel and smoked duocrete, stretch to the horizon like a great forest of structures, built by hundreds of different architects, both human and alien. This city dazzles the imagination, and has rightfully been the subject of much poetry and music. And now regarding the lowest levels. Deep in the lower, forgotten levels, in the oldest sub-basements of ancient buildings, an entire shadowy culture has developed. Coruscant's underworld is dank and oppressive, never seeing the sun or the night sky because of the looming shadows of kilometre-high buildings. Low-flying shuttles travelling near ground level must fly with all their running lights on and weapons powered up. Otherwise, the underworld is never travelled alone. The scale of the wealth disparity Vaughan mentioned in Washington DC is something that I find quite shocking, yet we see it replicated almost verbatim on Coruscant, including its current depiction. There are 5,120 levels on Coruscant that completely cover the planet's surface, though innumerable skyscrapers reach beyond this. The citizens in the highest levels live a life of luxury and privilege. The air is carefully filtered, everything is clean, the streets are largely safe, where carrion blasters is frowned upon. Lavish banquets are a common occurrence, and some of the best educational institutions in the galaxy call these levels home. The wealth of those on these upper levels is vast. In the extreme, we see individuals such as Xylan Graf, who is gifted a 2,000-floor building as an 18th birthday present. And this is at a time when the Republic is supposedly at its best, 200 years before the Phantom Menace. The lower levels, by contrast, literally stink of neglect. Frequently depicted as run down, dirty with rubbish strewn everywhere, and dumpster fires in the street. Drunken individuals passed out can be found almost everywhere, and the levels above trap toxic fumes, resulting in a wheezing chorus of coughing fits at every turn. The citizens of the lower levels, many of whom live in slums, can barely afford to eat, let alone an education. Even those with highly sought-after jobs, such as Jakar Bolmani, a munitions expert at the Jedi Temple, cannot afford to live elsewhere. Whilst nominally policed, these levels are largely abandoned by those who supposedly represent them, ceded to criminal gangs. In the time of the Empire, this becomes a sort of haven, particularly by those persecuted, such as many alien species and communities of Alderaanians. However, after the fall of the Empire, its abandonment intensifies, eventually spreading even to the upper levels by the time of the Hosnian Cataclysm. Again and again we see Star Wars media come back to one difference in particular, which I think is best shown in the following quote. In the Obi-Wan and Anakin comic by Charles Soule, one of the best Star Wars authors we have, by the way, We see this exchange between Palpatine and young Anakin. As rare as it is for Padawans to come down here, I believe it is even more unusual for one of these people to make it to the surface. Do you know the rarest resource on Coruscant, my boy? I'm not sure. The sky. Down here, the sun is a myth. The best example of life at these levels we see, on screen at least, is Trace and Rafa Martez, sisters who we meet in Season 7, Episode 5 of The Clone Wars. The Martez sisters live on level 1313, owning a repair shop on the edge of an underworld portal, massive ventilation shafts that descend from the highest levels of Coruscant to the lowest, often filled with traffic travelling between the different levels. Their lives are one of hardship, particularly after a green-skinned Jedi, who I can only imagine as Luminara, was faced with the trolley problem and killed their parents after directing a transport away from a crowded platform and into their home. What is telling is that despite, badly, attempting to console the sisters, they are offered no further support by either the Jedi or the Republic. The two scrape by. Trace working as a mechanic, and Rafa doing increasingly dangerous deals with the criminal underworld. Monetary concerns constantly overshadow their lives and the other citizens of the lower levels. Trace states, down here, everything has a price. Opportunities to pursue an education are non-existent. In Season 7, Episode 6, Trace says, first, there aren't any academies down here. Second, if there was, I couldn't afford it. As we see in the Palpatine quote, a differing life is little beyond a dream. Again, it is Trace who, in response to Ahsoka mentioning she's from the upper levels, wistfully comments, ah, up there where the air is clear. We do not know how their story finishes. We know that despite continuing to call level 1313 home, the sisters do get to see more of the galaxy and play an instrumental role in the early struggle against the Empire. This is not to say that the citizens of these levels are without their champions. In the children's comic Star Wars Adventures, issue number 25, we see Princess Leia and Amlin Holdo descend to level 4 in search of an ancient museum. The first 5 levels are thought to be uninhabitable. They're helped by Lady Forzar, who says to Leia, just don't forget us when you run the galaxy. You might not see us from the higher levels, but we're always here. To which Leia replies, I will never forget. In the penultimate panel of the comic, we once again return to the topic of the sky. On their return to the upper levels, Leia states, when you live in the higher levels, it's easy to forget not everyone can see the sky. To which Holdo replies, but we represent them too. It's up to us to lift up their voices. With such striking similarities to the divide Vaughn has described, you have to think of the importance of this lesson, and the fact that it comes in a children's comic really is the icing on the cake.
Well, Daniel, Vaughn, thank you both so much for that. I found that hugely enjoyable and hugely informative as someone who's kind of knows parts of the Star Wars canon, to kind of have that laid out and to apply it to the history that you were teaching us, Vaughn, there with regards to white flight and the movement of certain groups out of cities post-World War II. It's a fascinating thing to think about, because Star Wars, from my perspective, is this kind of stuff isn't like some sort of niche outside thing that is like been added to over time, even if it has been. From my perspective, as when I think of Star Wars, this is kind of the core stuff that comes to mind, and it's the stuff that I like. So, you know, it's not quite what we're talking about here, but things like with the boy with the broom from episode 8, and this idea of expanding the Star Wars universe out to the people who are on the ground and who are dealing with it, moving it beyond, you know, a family drama, and dealing with the fact that we are dealing with a universe of billions of people, and they are having to suffer through sort of social and economic hardships and continued disruption, and just trying to find a small slice, be that as, you know, engineers and on 1313, or be that higher up in the sky, or be that lower down in the ground. I find, just as a science fiction fan, I love some of the kind of more social economic aspects of Star Wars, fascinating to think about. And while, of course, you know, we all want to see lightsaber battles and we want to look at how cute Grogu is, actually one of the things that really stuck out with Andor is some of the exploration of the social economic issues, and getting a ground level view of how people are dealing with this this universe, which was first presented to us, you know, let's not forget, you know, with these farmers on Tatooine, and, you know, them having to deal with the life they are given and wanting more of it. So yeah, it all kind of feeds back, be it on a planet made of a city, or be it a planet made of a desert. It all fits together as one, as far as I'm concerned. Yes, so as I said, there's so much to dig into, and it's such an interesting topic to discuss in context of Star Wars in general, but then specifically how Vaughn fed that into it with her research. Steele, your own thoughts on this?
Yeah, with Coruscant, what I find quite fascinating, because there's a few city planets on in the Star Wars universe, but I feel like the thing that I always think about with Coruscant and the way that the Undercity, because I didn't even realize that there was an Undercity of Coruscant until the Clone Wars, when they started going down there for missions usually to do with the criminal element of Coruscant. And that's just where you go to find people and find information. And it's really interesting, because it's a huge juxtaposition compared to what you see in the prequels, because everything in Coruscant in the prequel takes place in the high buildings with the rich people, the senators. And it's interesting that there's this other side of that. Something that interests me is the fact that with it being an entire planet-wise city that goes up for 5,000 levels, like, they had to start somewhere, and they had to build buildings that were 3-5 stories and go up and up and up and up, which means that with the derelict Undercity, they probably just left it behind as they kept building, and then it just got filled up by people that were desperate. And I think that's it's a really interesting like concept. It's very similar. It reminds me a lot of in Blade Runner, how Earth is basically the Undercity, where it's just the only people that are left are the people that can't go off world, because everyone who can afford it, everyone who's healthy enough to go, they can all go off world, and the only people that are left are the poor, the disabled, and in the sequel, the replicants that are hunting other replicants. But it's very interesting how we have these stories where there are people that just get left behind, and places that just get left behind and then filled in by the desperate with nowhere else to go. It's obviously, there's lots of parallels to real life there, and it's very interesting, and it's depressing. I've on another note, I've been watching a lot of Star Trek recently, and I've never watched Star Trek before, and I've been watching The Next Generation, and it genuinely makes me depressed, because it's so optimistic. There's so much hope, and like, the people there, they gave up on capitalism. They gave up. There's an episode where someone from the past gets unfrozen.
Yes.
You know the one, Simon. He wants to speak to his bank. He wants to speak to he wants to go home and see what his investments are worth. Now it's thousands and thousands of years in the future. And I think it's only hundreds, actually. I've just realized this isn't Star Wars. And then Captain Picard tells him that people gave up on that a long time ago, and people stopped caring about what they could own, and they started caring about what they could see and what they could learn. And mm-hmm. it makes me so depressed because there's just no way that it's going to go that way. And it's really depressing. And I think this is for a science fantasy, I think there's elements in Star Wars that are so real. Mm-hmm. I think this is one of them. I think it's a great allegory for so many ways that lower class people are treated and places are just left to die. It's very interesting. There was one time where my first pictures in my Boba Fett costume were taken at an old brickworks that had just been left, and it's just a ruin now. But it's very Star Warsy, and obviously it's not taken care of at all, despite the fact it is a place of history. And it's just been left, and people have gone there to take pictures and to draw graffiti, but that's it. And there's so much like that, and it's very sad.
So one thing that I wanted to highlight from what all of you have been saying, and specifically what Daniel had said regarding Leia and Holdo being asked to remember the people of the lower levels on Coruscant. There's this lack of representation, and that's something that comes up every time we go to the lower levels, that they look at the people from the upper levels as entirely different from them because they have no representation for anything on the upper world. The upper world people come down for delights or criminal activity, or if they're the Jedi, they're investigating something, but there isn't really much social interaction between those groups. And as Daniel had said, people from the lower levels don't go up. So that like kind of physical distinction between them and the lack of representation where one group, the upper levels, get to use and exploit and have their dalliances in the underworld, but then come back up. That does remind me of DC very much, especially in the last year, because you may have seen recently the DC revised criminal code in the news. And this revised criminal code was approved unanimously by DC City Council, who are quite liberal. But it was vetoed by the mayor of DC. Congress also overturned this revision of the criminal code, and Biden vetoed it as well. And that was all on the federal level. That was all fueled by a Republican GOP counterattack against this revised code. One senator, Bill Hagerty from Tennessee, a Republican, said, quote, "What we've got is a DC city council that seems to be completely bent on achieving some sort of woke messaging on criminal justice reform, as opposed to worrying about the safety and security of people who come to visit and those who reside in this city." End quote. He was the lead sponsor of the retaliation against the criminal code that the city council, the elected city council of the people who live in Washington, D.C., had written. And he's a senator from Tennessee. Like, this just feels so on the nose when you look at it with Coruscant, that there are people who are not inhabitants of the city. They are only there for their job. Even if they are senators, like, yes, they have an apartment there, but the place they call home is their state. And they are visitors for as long as their term is, and we can get into a whole other conversation about congressional term limits, but they're visitors in D.C., and they are representatives of other places deciding what is right for this city against the wishes of the elected officials who do represent the people of the city. And it has this real kind of distance power play that Congress and even Biden would have the audacity to claim they know what's best for the people living in this city who wanted to be softer on crime and have more funding towards social efforts that would, as proven by many, many studies, that would lead to crime prevention. But they want to focus on a harder police and more funding for police and all of these things that the people do not want. While they are having their dalliances and going to DC for their jobs for a couple of years at most. And I think it really, really echoes a lot of what Daniel and Simon and Steele, what you've all been saying about Coruscant and these parallels.
Yeah, absolutely. It does make you wonder if we got a show that was like purely about Coruscant and was just like a, you know, a political drama set there.
If we got West Wing on Coruscant, I would love that. But that would be upper levels only, yes. Not really lower levels.
Yeah, I wonder if they did something that was more even just like sort of somewhere between, where it's almost like local council type stuff, where it's like people who have sort of a certain amount of power but aren't truly the higher ups, but are like dealing with people who are on maybe the lower end or whatever. And
I was going to say, if it revolved around, say, a representative from who'd grown up in the lower levels, and he's like the first person, or they are like the first person that's speaking for the Undercity for the first time, and we could see the way that people look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we could go into the corruption more, and obviously there's parts of this that was touched on in other shows, but it would be fascinating if it was a sort of dedicated show for that type of thing.
What's curious is that we don't get any reference to a senator or anything representing Coruscant until the time of the New Republic, when the capital is no longer on Coruscant. We know that in the time of the New Republic, certainly as we get towards the end of the year and we're approaching The Force Awakens, there are two senators that represent Coruscant at that point. And it's a curious detail, and it's, one has to wish that sort of like with two senators, you know, so I know one was a senior, one was a junior, that maybe finally they were starting to take it seriously, and you know, perhaps we could see that in the real world. But also, I suspect we also know at the time that they don't have the support that they desperately need, and that actually crime continues to be a greater and greater problem to the point where it threatens the upper levels.
Yeah, absolutely. It is fascinating to think about, isn't it? The sort of history of Coruscant, and I mean, you guys would know it better than me, but how that city/planet evolved over time, and its relationship to power and its relationship within the rest of the galaxy. Maybe this is something you guys know off the top of your head, but as someone who doesn't, it's interesting to think about how that kind of thing evolves, and the different types of stories you could tell along the way as it you know, as the levels get added to, and as the corruption grows.
I think because I didn't even, when I first watched the films when I was a kid, I didn't fully think about that. It was completely absent from my mind for a long time, the idea that there's an undercity and an underclass of people. And I didn't really realize until I played the Knights of the Old Republic games, because in that, it's not set on Coruscant, it's on a different city planet, but you start off in the upper city, and then you move to the lower levels, and then finally for a mission you have to go into the undercity, which is more or less condemned. And I believe there was a plague down there or something, or just the air filtration just broke and killed everyone. And I realized to myself, oh, of course, that happens on Coruscant as well. And then when I watch the Clone Wars episodes that are set down there, you realize just what a terrible place it is, because there's no one investing any time, energy, or money into it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've only watched sporadic episodes of Clone Wars TV show, as you guys have recommended them to me. But it's been... I've enjoyed pretty much every episode you provided, and the four episodes that I just watched there have been a continuation of the fact that I'm able to kind of get an expansion of what my Star Wars experience is. And I'm thinking about people outside of the kind of classic canon of the films. And I think that something like Clone Wars is an excellent way to frame the rest of the Star Wars universe or Star Wars galaxy for especially younger viewers. And in the episodes I was watching with the two sisters, you know, this idea of they don't really know too much about Jedi, but they know they don't trust them kind of thing. And the kind of incredulous response from the Jedi who's in their presence, who they're not actually aware of at that time. And it does kind of reframe it from this, you know, these are these holy knights who are saving the galaxy, to they are just another person who is flying up in the stars above us and who, you know, we don't know by name and probably won't help us in any meaningful way. It's an interesting reframing of everything when you start seeing it through characters like those two.
Well, what I like in the episodes, I like it as a storytelling choice, not as an actual action by a person. But I like when they go down to the Undercity, the Jedi. They turn when Ahsoka's with them, for example. They're always a bit like. There was a bit like, this area is rough, or this place is dangerous, and it's like, guys, you know the Chancellor, like you know the person who's in charge, and you just sort of accept this status quo that it's like this. Yeah. Like, it's the Jedi and their complacency. I think that's why so many characters like Trace and Rava, they believe the Jedi are just nothing. They're just puppets of a corrupt government. They're just glorified police, and especially when during the Clone Wars, where they become warmongers, and I think that's why it was so easy for Palpatine to convince the galaxy that they wanted the war to keep going and that they tried to take over. It's very interesting.
Absolutely, and that...
Just, I was going to say that point of like, you guys know the Chancellor, like this is literally your thing and your job, and you're telling people that it's unsafe here when you are the peacekeepers. Like, Chuck Schumer voted with Republicans to overturn the revised criminal code for DC. Democrats voted with Republicans to overturn it. And I've said it before, I'll say it again. The Jedi are Democrats. Like they literally are part of this. Biden is a Democrat and overturned a Democrat city council's revised criminal code because he didn't think it went hard enough on crime. Like, and I mean, classic Joe Biden move. He voted for every crime bill in the past 40 years, but that's not factual. That's exaggeration. just so you know. But it is that kind of like, you know the Chancellor. What are you doing criticizing this place that is right next door to your home? And you're like, oh, I wouldn't go there. It's seedy. It's literally your job to protect it. Like, Congress literally is the executive legislative body for DC. And they're just like, oh, this place is disgusting. Somebody should do something about this. It's your job. It's literally your job. Sorry, Simon.
A couple of things there. No, that's absolutely fine. A couple of things there. One, when you start saying Biden and then talking about the Jedi, I was trying to think, oh, Biden won Kenobi? I was trying to put something together which was vaguely connected there.
How dare you?
They both have very similar levels of sex appeal. And then... and then the other
Vaughn,
thing I was going to say...
Is, moan. Vaughn doesn't moan when she talks about Biden.
No, I don't. No, that would never happen. Obi-Wan, yes. Biden, no.
Her centrist thing.
Gross.
What I was going to say as well is one of the things I respect most about the prequels and respect most about George is that even though I have issues with some of the technical underpinnings of those films and some of the sort of writing choices, the actual larger picture take that he had to reframe the Jedi and their collapse and their incompetence as kind of the reason why we get the original trilogy that we do, I think is a really fascinating story, and I'm really glad he told that because it allowed us to open up a different world with other TV shows and things like that that I think have done a better job of telling that type of story. But it's so great that he was able to use that as his kind of prequel starting point and show that it wasn't like they were these complete, you know, it wasn't a black and white things where these wonderful guardians were somehow defeated by these evil people, you know, that they were complicit and they were their inaction and inability to actually be the people that we think they should be, and showing how flawed they were and how, you know, the kind of classic human idea of, you know, an individual person is good and a group of people are bad kind of thing. It is kind of applied to the heroes of the original trilogy, and you know, the Jedi force that we kind of grew up with in the trilogy is kind of reframed when you think of the inaction of the Jedi's in the prequels. So yeah, I like I say, I have some issues with some of the prequels, but his choice to show what you guys were just talking about there with the sort of Democrats in action, I think was a fantastic and thrilling choice actually to make to almost re-examine the own legacy of your favorite characters.
I think that's what's brilliant about the Clone Wars is how well it takes what's set up in the prequels, especially the politics, and fleshes them out, and also makes it in a way that's digestible for kids. Mm. Like, it's so important having stories where, like cautionary tales to tell children to see corruption. Mm. We've talked about corruption on this show before, where we talked about the Mandalore arc with corruption, and also we have episodes where there's a micro scale version of the plan with Palpatine, except there's a so with Maul where he sets up a puppet governor, like someone in charge who's he's a complete puppet under Darth Maul's control, and creates a crisis to get that person into power. It's brilliant, and it's just so good that we have these stories that children can see, and then they can see the parallels and discover this themselves. It's really important.
Yeah. And I think what's really interesting, again, Clone Wars is absolutely brilliant, truly fleshing out the Star Wars universe, is that, yeah, obviously I know in this podcast you've talked about corruption before, but with the Jedi, as you were touching on, Simon, we see a different kind of corruption, or sort of like an incompetence. There's a complete disconnect between themselves and the ordinary citizens of the galaxy. You know, we see in Clone Wars, so another brilliant arc actually for looking at the underworld is or the lower levels is the final arc of season 5, because at the beginning of that we see the Jedi, so we see Anakin and Ahsoka investigating an bomb at the Jedi Temple, and as part of the investigation they go to the main suspect's apartment, And it's in the lower levels, and it's, you know, it is run down. There's rubbish everywhere. And, you know, Ahsoka makes the comment, I would have thought working for the Jedi paid better. And then later on, as Ahsoka finds herself in the lower levels again, she meets up with Ventress. And as part of her argument, Ventress says, not everyone on Coruscant lives in a luxurious temple on the surface. There's that complete lack of understanding of what life is truly like for citizens of the galaxy, because we don't, and I don't think the Jedi are portrayed, I don't think necessarily are, but they're certainly not portrayed as bad people in the Clone Wars, and yet we see so clearly their fall, and we see so clearly that complete incompetence, really, as they've fallen so far from their way. But what's also interesting is that, you know, this isn't new in the Star Wars universe. This has been going on for hundreds of years. You know, I know that Still and Vaughn don't know too much about the High Republic era, but, you know, this is an era that's starting to be explored in Star Wars through various media. And it's supposed to be, you know, sort of like the Jedi and the Republic at the height of the sort of like their power, at their noblest. This is a time where, you know, the Republic is genuinely reaching out beyond its borders to help worlds in need. And yet we're still seeing this on Coruscant, and we're still seeing this complete disconnect. I was actually literally on the way here reading a book where sort of like, oh, the Jedi come in to save the day, and oh yeah, no, they just completely muck up the ceasefire between one planets. It's just, yeah, it's so weird that they're the good guys and they're supposed to be best, and yet the disconnect is so stark.
I think Another great exploration into that is the Dooku-centric episodes of Tales of the Jedi.
Yes.
They are incredibly written, incredibly paced, incredibly made shorts. They're 20 minutes each, if that. And they are incredible at showing how someone could become so disillusioned with the Jedi and the Republic, but mainly the Jedi and what they stand for, and how that's been lost over time. In the first episode, a much younger Dooku and Qui-Gon, they go to a planet where the son of their representative has been kidnapped, and they go there asking, and they turn up and they try and look tough, and they put their lightsabers on the table as a show of strength, and then they explain that we have the son, he's being kept very well, and he's there. We are doing it out of sheer desperation because this person is taking all of the money he makes off world and keeping it, and no one knows anything about it because there's no one to check. And in the end, Dooku makes the choice to stand with them instead of rescuing and standing with the representative, and yeah, he ends up giving into his anger there. And in the second episode, it goes even further because he's working with Mace Windu, who is very by the book to the point of ignoring what's right in front of him. And but he's the best part is Mace Windu's genuinely confused about what Dooku's doing, because Dooku says, well, we've got some time, let's ask some questions, let's go investigate. And Mace Windu's like, we've got what we came for, why do we need to do this? Like, what's the point? And it's like, well, it's not necessarily as black and white as all that. And Mace Windu says, yeah, but the council basically says, yeah, but the council just told us to do this, and that's what I'm here to do. And it's just, it's very interesting. There's so many characters like Mace Windu who are good Jedi on paper because they follow what they're told to do. But with the Jedi becoming the puppets of the Republic, who are just as stale in their ability to take care of everyone or even notice people in need because they're so far away and so corrupt. It's brilliant storytelling. It's genuinely very special. Those three episodes just show very well how a character that hasn't had enough development just gives you everything you need in less than about 45 minutes for the three episodes. It's wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
I was nodding.
It's also funny to think if you it's also funny to think if you reconsider the Jedi as like Mayor Pete and Bill Clinton just running around with lightsabers. Something has a very different image, doesn't it? It's like
just that Robot Chicken sketch. I forget.
Yeah, it's so good. Mr. President, your midichlorian count is incredibly high. You're not tired. You want to have a threesome. Get me Condi. funnily enough, George Lucas, when he was asked, because the prequels, he says that they're about the Bush era. But he said about Bill Clinton saying that he was a good man in a bad circumstance.
Okay. Vaughn, you've been in similar circumstances. What's your opinion on Bill Clinton?
Jesus, Simon. I was still thinking about Mayor Pete holding a lightsaber, actually. Like, on one of his little
killing his family. Imagine Mayor Pete killing his own family to get a slightly better promotion.
Imagine? Like... That's
like Order 66, just so we can like get a better cabinet position.
I'm pretty sure we've talked about that in our group.
We have. Yeah.
King of the Rats.
King of the Rats.
instead of a lightsaber, it's just Charlie Kelly's rat stick.
Guys. Right, this is getting out of hand and I blame myself.
Which, hold on, I'm not done with the Unhinged. Yeah. What Jedi would Mayor Pete be? Probably Ki-Adi Mundi, right? I would think that.
Who Ki-Adi Mundi, who says the famous line, send in the flamethrowers.
Yeah, the peacekeepers, right?
Yeah. That would be Mayor Pete, yeah. And then he gives a nice spin to it in the council meeting of like, it was necessary. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Would he ask about the droid attack on the Wookiees, though?
He would if it got him better polling.
I'm just seeing that guy with a Ki-Adi Mundi sized head now.
You're welcome. I hope everybody envisions
Thank
this.
You.
Is there anything else to add about, you know, white flight and the other things like that?
Right, or, gentrification and class dynamics and urbanism. the things we're
yeah, or shall we just start trying to name Democratic Jedi?
Chuck Schumer would be Yaddle.
Yaddle.
No, we can stop.
I mean, this feels like a separate podcast, just us naming Democratic Jedi.
I was just actually wondering quickly on the topic of gentrification, kind of sort of like before, because I can think of some examples kind of sort of outside of Coruscant, but just wanted to ask sort of like Steele and Vaughn quickly if they had any thoughts on gentrification in Star Wars itself, particularly Coruscant, before I go on something else.
Canto Bight in The Last Jedi. That's an interesting one, and I think it doesn't get as much as it should. Doesn't get as much like notice as it should, especially because in the movies, especially in the sequels, that's about as political as they get a lot of the time. Like, mm-hmm. I think they wanted to play it as safe as possible. But yeah, I love The Last Jedi. I actually cannot wait for our Last Jedi episode.
That's good. That's going to be fun. And just out of interest, just so I could play along, because obviously I don't know the Jedi as well as you do, shocker. So I just googled the worst Jedi, and there was an article that came up on What Culture called the 10 Worst Jedi Masters. And then number 3 just says, all the Jedi Masters who tried to take down Sidious.
Yeah. They all suck. Nice one.
Oof.
So where's Mace Windu? Where's Mace Windu on that? And I'm guessing Pong Krell is number 1, right?
Mace Windu is number 4.
Yeah, tracks.
Well, that's...
And...
Who's number one?
Okay, I was just looking at... Because I was looking at some of the more fancy named ones. It's one of those annoying articles, though, where they do it a different page per entry.
That should be illegal.
That should be illegal. Just give me 10 names. But I am just at number one now. And they've gone for number one is Pongkrell.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Makes sense.
Simon, do you know who Pongkrell is yet?
Literally no idea.
Oh my god, that's gonna be an episode. My god.
We'll do that one soon. Don't worry.
We're all gonna get real sad.
Real sad. It hurts your heart.
Real fucking sad. I think that was the thing that was the best thing in the Bad Batch was the way the treatment of the clones and as they're being sort of rotated out and becoming obsolete. It's just brilliant. Sorry to get getting slightly off topic here, especially right at the end. But it's just, I love that that's something that they carried on, because they always, in that arc, the Pongkrell arc, they ask the questions of what happens to us after the war? We're soldiers. What do we do next? And we're getting those answers in. I mean, we knew anyway, because obviously they're not around in the original trilogy, but we're seeing the mistreatment that they're getting, and it's just, it's very depressing, but it's also very real. It's good writing.
To bring that full circle back to what we were talking about, we get a lot in a lot of recent stuff of homeless veterans, and it's not the gentrification part, but I had mentioned that 4,500 people in DC are homeless, and our elected officials are walking past them daily going, somebody should do something about this, and forgetting that it's literally their fucking job. But I think that I just find it really interesting that we can look into a space like Coruscant over so many years of history in the Star Wars galaxy and see different representations of it and how it changes through different governments, through different time periods, with different characters that we know as they change throughout time, and how they interact with the space becomes different and changes the identity of the space of Coruscant. And there's that great quote in a recent episode of The Mandalorian, where this like wealthy elite in Coruscant says, oh, are you from the Empire, or was it, or I was drafted for the Empire or the Resistance or the New Republic. I can't keep any of them straight. And he just doesn't give a shit. And genuinely, I believe that character has no idea what the difference between the Resistance and the Empire and the New Republic are. And I find that to be the kind of most compelling quote from somebody on the upper levels of Coruscant, because there are homeless people and there are these people who are impoverished literally like 5 minutes away from them, just down, and they have no idea and do not care to know. Or if they do know, they don't care to do anything. And that's something that just kind of full circle. I think really the history of DC and Coruscant are very closely paralleled, thematically and topically and politically and economically.
Yeah, the parallels between what you describe, Vaughn, and what we see on Coulson are terrifying. You know, we see people in those lower levels, not even like struggling to put a roof over their heads, they're struggling to find food, just their meal for the day. And yet, as you say, directly above, it's this completely different world. What was it? You said at the beginning it was an 81% difference, was it, in wealth between white and black people?
White households have 81 times the wealth of
81
black
times.
Households.
Yeah, Jesus.
So,
it beggars belief, and also the fact that this so dystopian world of the lower levels of Coruscant always matches, you know, real life in DC verbatim is It's terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And Coruscant, obviously, with the kind of structure from a visual sort of representation of the kind of the lower levels with the poor and the higher levels, obviously, with the wealth. And, you know, we see similar things as you touched on, Steve, with Blade Runner and things like Fifth Element. And that's a great sort of science fiction visual representation of the disparity between those on the bottom rung of society and those on the top. But as Vaughn said, even though we don't have that sort of visual representation in real life to the same degree, we absolutely have that baked into many cities throughout the world, and DC is a great example, which you gave, Vaughn, of the those who are in power and those who have wealth essentially walking past those who don't and who are poor or those who are homeless, and, you know, uttering the words, someone should do something about this. Or as it sometimes is now, someone should just get rid of these people. So yeah, it's science fiction is in part played to reflect what society is and what it could be for better or worse, and that visual representation of Coruscant is a sad but accurate representation of the world we live in, unfortunately.
Just a point to end on here, unless anybody else has anything to say. Coruscant, or Coruscant, however you want to say it, the like English word means shining and shimmering, like a glittery, beautiful thing that shines. And I find that really interesting that they used Coruscant as the name of this city planet, because the top is glittering and absolutely is, but the lower levels definitely are not. They don't even see the sun and the sky. I just find it really interesting that the actual name of the planet only refers to those on top and on the surface and that shimmering surface, and completely ignores the vast majority of the actual population that live below. That also feels very much like DC in a way, that when we the kind of connotation of the words Washington DC or the District of Columbia, like they give us this vision of the Capitol building, the Smithsonian, the National Mall, but actually if you are there in person, you see poverty and you see homeless people and you see the absolute social failings and political decisions that have led to people not being able to live their lives. So I do think that name is very stark and very telling, even just in itself.
No, that's a great addition, Vaughn, absolutely. Right, is there anything else to add, or shall we move on to our first in-person quiz from Daniel?
I was just one more thing that just came into my mind was in a recent episode of The Mandalorian, there was a really lovely bit where they visited the peak of the highest mountain, and it's like the scaffolding that they're walking on, the walkway that they're walking on is like almost level, just enough that a person is about the height of a person is where the top is, and there are countless buildings bigger than it, and it's terrifying because there's nothing natural left on Coruscant, which means that the people that live in the impoverished areas, they have nowhere to go. Like they can't, even if they put all the money they had together and tried to get somewhere else where it's easier to live, there's nowhere to go for them. Like there's nothing, there's no options, because all they have is this endless undercity, and there's no way of getting above it, and there's no rural areas to go to, there's no greener places, there's no quieter areas, there's nothing. It's just endless.
This is where sort of like the only option people have to escape Coruscant, if they're lucky enough for this to even be an option, is to get off planet, is to escape to other parts of the galaxy. We So again, this is in the High Republic era, but the great sort of like catalyst for a lot of the problems in that is something called the Great Disaster, and that starts with the wreckage of this transport that is taking literally thousands of people from the core of the galaxy. So one has to think of Coruscant initially when you think of that, to the outer rim, so they can start a better life, because there's nothing for them where they're coming from. And, you know, yes, the outer rim is lawless and it's a dangerous place, but at least, you know, at least there's nature there, at least there's a chance, at least they could have a life. And it is sad that, you know, even these people that can't best themselves in the core on Coruscant have to escape. These are the lucky ones as well. You know, there are so many people that can't even afford. These people will have put everything into this journey, and yet there are still so many worse off than them that can't even do that.
I think the other option is like Rava does in the Clone Wars, and that's turned to crime.
Yeah.
Which is always a valid option. shall we close up here on this topic then and move on to the quiz?
Mm-hmm. On that depressing note.
On that depressing note, yeah. Who'd have thought wealth inequality would end on a bummer, right?
Something with very clear parallels to the real world? What? Why would that be depressing?
Woof.
It's fine. We'll do a watch-along episode at some point and everyone will be much more cheery.
With gin.
With gin.
No.
And yaddle.
Chuck Schumer.
Right. Daniel, do you have the quiz at hand?
I do indeed, yes. So with this quiz, I've made it specifically all about Coruscant. Most of the answers will be specific to this. There are a few that will delve elsewhere. So be ready?
Yes.
Yep.
Let's do it.
Alrighty-o. So, question one. What are the galactic coordinates for Coruscant?
What do you think, Simon? This is a quiz that Simon gets to play as well. So I want Simon to give an answer first for all of them.
Okay, my stock answer will be, it'll probably be something like some nerd ass July 4th in binary type answer. I have no idea. Seven?
Just seven.
Seven.
Oh no, that's one of my friends now.
What do you think, guys?
Eight?
Is this like The Price is Right, where you just guess one above or one below?
Is it not supposed to be the center of the Star Wars galaxy? So wouldn't it be like zero?
I will take that. The answer is 000.
Whoa!
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. I got one.
I was eight off.
I was only seven off.
Yeah, Simon was pretty closer. Good.
Take that, Steve. I could have chosen. I was only eight off. That's a big deal, guys. That's a big deal.
All right. Alrighty-o. So question two is, what common species is thought to have originated on Coruscant?
Simon?
I'm going to go with Yaddle.
Can you imagine a whole planet of Chuck Schumers? Yaddle? Well, I guess that would be New York, wouldn't it?
Unknown species.
Guys, any addition to my obviously accurate guess?
Of course. I don't know.
I don't know.
Maybe I can't remember because there's no definitive like answer of where the humans first originated, like, but I don't think it's, I don't think it's that. I know a whole lot of characters are born on Coruscant, but that's not the same as a species originating. I'm gonna pass, I think. But yeah, go for it.
Okay. Well, before I give the answer, Vaughn, did you have any thoughts?
I'll steal Steele's answer and say humans. Steele's non-answer.
Okay. Well, you would be correct. It is.
Damn.
It is. Yes. It is humans that are commonly thought to have originated on the planet. It is not known for certain, but it is largely considered to be the homeworld of humans.
Okay. So we don't know for sure. So it could be Yaddle. So there's still like an outside chance.
Is the answer 7?
This time it's 8.
Well, on that note, the answer to this question is another number. So, question 3. How many hours does one full rotation of Coruscant take?
Ooh.
Well, surely
that's...
It's
not going to be 24, is it? Is it 8? Is the answer humans?
How long is that... When they cut between Anakin and Padme right before Order 66, that feels like it takes forever, right?
Oh, where the music's all like...
Yeah, and they just keep cutting between them, and you're like, do something. That feels like that's 20 hours, so...
That is the greatest excuse for bad filmmaking I've ever heard. Well, actually, canonically, the planet's rotations take longer, so naturally.
Oh, hey, George. Nice of you to finally join.
I was too busy making poetry.
It takes quite a while to make a rhyme, so I excuse
it. It does. Sometimes it's 7 and sometimes it's 8.
Sometimes you're 17.
It's Yaddle.
So, any thoughts?
I'll go with 15 because that's 8 and 7 added together.
Oh, I feel like how big is Coruscant? It's a big old boy, isn't it? Is it bigger than the Earth? Oh, he's doing a shrug, everybody.
What?
Yeah, Vaughn, break out your encyclopedic knowledge.
Well, it's just this that like it would have no bearing if it was the same size as the Earth or not, because it's a different fucking galaxy, isn't it? Like. You know what I mean?
That's another great example of an excuse for bad filmmaking right there. It's another galaxy, isn't it?
So it is, though. Like, it is, though, is the thing. How long is it as a day?
How long is a piece of string? I'm going to say 29 hours.
29 hours? Vaughn?
20.
Okay, I think you're the closest, but you have already said the answer. It is 24 hours.
You are joking. No.
So Coruscant is actually supposed to be effectively a stand-in for Earth because the size of Coruscant is also roughly the same size as Earth.
Whoa!
That doesn't make any sense, George! That doesn't make any goddamn sense! I don't know science, but I know that's not right.
Finally, we found something to pick George apart on. It's taken however many episodes.
Yeah, just the one thing there.
That's just the one, the only thing so far.
What's Ahsoka's early seasons when she's 14 outfit? What were we talking about there, guys?
Well, we should ask George since he's with us.
Oh, God. Let me tell you something about Bill Clinton. He makes a great rhyme.
Oh no.
Oh, playing sexy jazz. shall we move on to the next?
If he was in my universe, he'd be playing jizz music.
Very good.
I do love my sweet jizz music.
Vaughn's staying especially silent on this one. Let's move on.
We have enough quotes from me. Yes, Daniel. Next question.
So this is the last one where the answer is a number. How many moons does Coruscant have?
Well, it's going to be one, isn't it? Because that's what they're about.
So is that your answer, Simon?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Is it Yaddle?
That's no moon, that's a Yaddle.
I'm going to say 7.
Seven.
I'm going to guess 1 because Simon's indignation when he said that was one of my favorite things I've ever heard.
So I'm afraid the answer is 4.
Oh, what?
We have Ascendant, oh, wow. 1-3, and Hesperidium.
So George was like, right, it's Earth. And they're like, well, that's a bit boring. He's like, oh, okay, it's got 3 other moons. So yeah, that was basically George coming up.
It's got 4 moons, and 3 of them are called Syntax.
The age of consent is lower on those 3.
I tell you, on Syntax 2, the midriff's out there, you know? I'm going to go to my ranch now.
Oh, boy.
Right.
Right, next question.
We can cut that out. But next question.
Wow. Oh, I'm not going to sleep tonight. Okay. Question 5. Name 3 buildings in the Federal District.
I know. Let's see, what would George come up with? So we have the Empire State Building, Big Ben. Which other ones would he choose?
No,
the
no,
Big Yaddle.
The Republic State Building.
The Republic State Building.
So,
I'm going to say, I can't remember if the Federal District is where everything basically happens in the movies. And if so, I'm going to say, the Senate. I'm going to say the Jedi Temple. I'm going to say Dex's Diner, Dexter Jetster's 1950s cafe.
Ooh,
where's my Disney Plus series?
So, so Dex's Diner, is incorrect, but the others are correct.
Boom!
So one more.
I was going to say the 2 of those also. Do we go
actually,
anywhere
just
else?
So
Mon Mothma's house?
Just where she lives, her house.
Yeah.
So I don't think we know the name of that building, but there is a building in this area called 500 Republica, which is where a lot of senators live. But just very quickly, I was going to give one quick clue. You said the Senate building?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there are actually 2 different buildings in relation to the Senate. So which one?
The Senate.
Cool.
Sorry, just to say, I think we're getting some feedback on the mics or repetition on the mics. Yeah. So we're missing one more. And Steele, sorry, did you have a thought on what that might be?
I know. Okay, so I know that the Republic, the clone troopers have a base where it has all the statues, and they walk the weird dogs around the outside in those Ahsoka episodes. That's a cool building. I know that's probably one of them if that's in the Federal District. 2 Senate buildings, though, that's getting me. Unless Sheev lives in a separate building to the rest of the Senate.
So, firstly, you would be correct. The Republic Center for Military Operations is indeed in the Federal District, so that's correct. And then just to clarify with the Senate building, so we have Senate building, so we have that, but we also have, which is also known as the Senate Rotunda, so that's where the Senate itself sits, but then we also have the Senate Office Building. So there's a completely separate building where they have their offices. It's because when you're in it, sort of like in the films, you see, well, basically, sort of like the Senate building itself has the huge dome on top. It looks like a giant mushroom, essentially. But then the Senate office building is kind of sort of like more sleek. And that's where, for example, when Cad Bane takes Sinister's hostage.
Oh,
it's,
yeah.
It's that building there, which is different in shape to where the Senate itself sits.
Sure. I want to watch that episode again. It's been a while.
That's a good episode. Shall we go on to question six?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Right, so I know that Still knows the answer to this question. What was the name of the cancelled video game that was set in the lower levels of Coruscant?
Yeah, 1313. I say yeah, I'm actually really sad about it. Basically,
yeah, you've talked about this on the show, haven't you? I remember you talking about 1313 before on the show still.
Yeah, I mentioned it earlier on this one. I think I might have mentioned it before, but it's one of those...
you have, because I remember us talking about it, yeah.
I think it was interesting because it was going to revolve in the Coruscant underworld, and it was going to be the best... It's probably going to be the most detailed look we ever got into it. At the time when the Clone Wars episodes were coming out, in season 5, I think, they go to 13... Ahsoka goes to 1313, and then... Trace and Rava, they're on 1313 as well. And I think that was back because those episodes were originally planned and written to come out back before the Clone Wars was cancelled. So it was all around the same time, even though Trace and Rava were going to be replaced by just one character, and it was going to be a male character. But all of that was around 1313 to try and keep mentioning it. So people who could, when the game came out, they'd know what it was about. And it was going to revolve around, I don't know too much, because the only thing we really saw was a few behind the scenes things and a bit of gameplay footage of a crashing freighter that was going down into the underworld through the massive tubes where loads of vehicles descend. And I think somewhere quite near down the making of the game, I think the rumor is, I've heard this before, don't quote me on it, but I believe George came in and went, make it about a young Boba Fett.
Yeah, I've heard that before. And seen the footage with it as Boba Fett in the early drafts of it, yeah.
Because I think that only, like, any, like, gameplay with a young Boba, I'm pretty sure that only just came out like in the last year, because there was a video that I've seen years ago of the original protagonist it was going to revolve around. He was played by, he was motion captured the same way they do with Fallen Order, I believe, with the guy that plays Dex in season three of Daredevil. Good actor, very good actor. And we never got to see that. I assume they would have completely scrapped all of that if the game would have come out with a young Boba Fett. Great costume on Boba, though. Really good. There's a custom Lego minifigure that's very expensive, but I want it. So that's my rant for the episode.
I mean, I knew you'd know the answer to that question. I figured it. I also am not surprised that it came up previously in this episode as well. But anyway, question 7. Who was the commander of the Coruscant Guard during the Clone Wars?
Oh, I know this one. I know this one. Does anyone else know this one before I do it?
If this is Yaddle, I'm going to feel so stupid.
It's Yaddle! Oh my goodness, Hatno!
I wish it was Yaddle. Would have been much better if it was Yaddle.
I don't know, obviously.
If I'm thinking of the right commander, it's Commander Fox.
That is correct.
Yeah, Commander Fox was the first clone commander I had in Lego. Still one of my favorite minifigures. Quite hated among the community because he kills a fan favorite character. But he's only doing his job, but he killed a character that everyone loved, and I also loved. He also gets killed by Darth Vader in a comic. Basically, Vader goes to the Jedi Temple, and Fox kind of has a moment where he gives him a bit of attitude, and Vader just kills him, just straight up kills him. And like, this is a character that we'd seen since not even season one of the Clone Wars, but the movie that came out in cinemas that was terribly animated and really rushed. But he was there in that, and he was always he's always been there. And then he becomes the Coruscant Guard very quickly. The more Clone Wars delves into the Republic being not a good thing, but a morally grey and corrupt thing, the Coruscant Guard, the red clone troopers, start becoming more threatening. And when they get their armor update, when they go to phase two from phase one, they have this red that's very intimidating. In the most recent, well, not most recent, the last week's episode of the Mandalorian, there was a flashback, and the red troopers there are terrifying because the 501st blue troopers are doing the attack just like in the prequels. But then the Coruscant Guard turn up later, and it's just like, oh, things are going down now. These guys are terrifying. That was my second rant of the day.
I was going to say that's a second rant, but that's okay. We love to hear you speak still. Shall we move on to the next question?
Yep, absolutely. Question eight is, what building is converted into the Imperial Palace?
Ooh. What do we think, guys?
Isn't that
the Jedi Temple?
Ancient Jedi Temple? Yeah. Isn't it?
So, or
it was a beacon? Was it the beacon?
What was that for?
It was like an ancient beacon or something.
So the answer is the Jedi Temple.
Oh, that's a move. That is. That's a little screw you. I like that. I mean, you know, terrible, but it's... I think wasn't there like an ancient Sith? Like underneath Coruscant, there was an ancient Sith.
That's what I'm thinking of.
So that is kind of it in many ways. So, because what's interesting is that the Jedi Temple is actually itself built on top of the peak of a mountain on Coruscant, and in the peak of that mountain is an ancient Sith temple. So the idea is that the Jedi were effectively trying to suppress the darkness of this Sith temple by basically putting the headquarters on top of it, not really thinking that maybe if they put their headquarters on top of the Sith temple that it might corrupt them. But hey, I'm sure they know what they're doing.
they've got a good track record on knowing exactly what they're doing, don't they?
I certainly trust them.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, question nine. What is the name of the club seen in Attack of the Clones?
Is it Yaddle?
Come on, guys! This is one of the best Star Wars films. We should be knowing this.
It's the second best. It's the second best Star Wars film. Time it. I don't know what the club is called.
Fake fan.
Death Sticks.
Yeah.
Club Death Sticks. Yes.
Club Death Sticks. Good. Yeah.
Mr. Elan Sleazebagano.
My idol. So,
you're cosplaying as one of his race at Celebration, aren't you?
When we're shooting this weekend at Celebration, I'm going as a Balisar, the species of Elan Sleazebagano. But what club do we see him in?
I cannot remember, but I'm going to say it's the Dirty Jawa.
Is that something from somewhere that rings a bell?
And I my can't third
remember.
Wife.
I just remember about chicken. But everyone who didn't know what Vaughn was just referencing, just YouTube, just check on YouTube, the Calrissian Chronicles written by AI is brilliant. And this guy who's never read it before, doing a great Billy Dee Williams impression, just like cracking up at this. So good.
Oh my God, it's been years since I've heard that. Oh, wow. Anyway, would we like the answer?
Do it.
The answer is the Outlander Club.
The Outlander Club. Cool.
There you go.
On it.
I still think Yaddle would have been a good name for a
club. Yes! Absolutely.
That was a good guess, Gil.
Thank you.
So, question 10. The building where Palpatine oversees the medical procedure to save Darth Vader and integrate him into his iconic suit uses what type of facility as a cover for its secret operations?
So I know that he had the surgery at the newly named Emperor Palpatine Surgical Reconstruction Center. Thanks for that one, Wikipedia.
I'll go with laundromat.
The laser tag. Oh wait, no, lasers aren't special, so it'd be a bullet tag.
Wow. That's some type of surgery. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. I actually didn't have that name down, but I know you are correct on that. The name before that was the Grand Republic Medical Facility, but the answer I was sort of like looking for was a hospital. He builds on top of a hospital, but yeah, you're absolutely correct.
I love the idea that there's a statue of Emperor Palpatine in the foyer with his monster face.
And there's probably like a little hospital gift shop where you can pick up your Big Daddy Pulp's stuff.
Emperor Palpatine branded bathrobes that are black, exactly. And they have the little tie on the top.
Right. Shall we move on to the next?
So, question 11. No, the 15, by the way, as they often are. Question 11. Name a location in London that was used to film scenes set on Coruscant. And I will give you a clue. Both of them featured in Andor.
Pinewood Studios.
I'm going to cut this all. Like, let me just cut. I'm talking sort of like more central London, I should say.
I know. I just thought that would be fair to say. I don't actually know.
I know that one of them was the ISB... one of them was the ISB headquarters, and I can't remember where that was.
Was it Senate House? Maybe? No?
If I remember, I know that scenes in Rogue One in the base were filmed at one of the tube stations. I think it was Canary Wharf. I can't remember. I know Andor did a lot of filmmaking... just in general, no. Did a lot of shooting on location. There was the scenes where he's in the tourist destination were shot in Blackpool, I believe. But no, I cannot remember. I cannot remember where it was shot. Go on, hit
the
me.
ISB. Okay, looks so... like Senate House Library, but I don't know if it
so...
is.
It's possible I'm missing a trick with the ISB building, but the two that I have the answer is so we have the Barbican, which is seen. So we see shots of this right before the tense exchange between Take Homer and Leader Mothma. How do you pronounce her name? Right. Anyway, do an assignment. But we also.
I was gonna say you're actually forming sentences while reading these questions, so you're most definitely not doing assignment.
And then we also have the Brunswick, which is used in shots as Cyril Khan approaches his mum's apartment.
Hmm.
Oh yes, that was it. I was watching a video on this recently of where they shot, and it's really. It's really cool how creative they were, because a lot of the landscaping around that area looks very like it wouldn't be too difficult to make it look like a cyberpunk hellscape.
Yeah. Yeah. And just quickly, I know you were wondering about the shot in of Scarif in Rogue One. So that was Canary Wharf station. So which is only a stone's throw away from where Celebration is going to be. So,
oh God, there's going to be so many people.
Yes, there are
in Imperial cosplay running through them.
Yes, there are. Yeah.
Yep. Probably for the best. The Jubilee line's not running. To be honest, that might be why.
Okay. Right. So, question 12: what is the name of the cantina often frequented by clone troopers on Coruscant? Which we recently saw in the Bad Batch.
We did. I remember. I just can't remember what it's called. Is it called the Dirty Yaddle?
Is it like Club 99 or something? Is that something else? Is that a sex move? Is that a clone sex move?
It's definitely a sex move. Everything is a sex move. The Dirty Yaddle is a sex move.
Position 99.
Just 7 and 8 are a sex move.
George, do you have any opinions on this?
Well, you know, poetry is a sex move. It just has to rhyme. You know, every time I have sex, I do it on a green screen.
What a beautiful image.
So,
in order of George, I'll go with the midriff.
Right. So, we have... Okay, did you have an answer still? No. So you're on to something, Vaughn, but it's actually... it sounds like another sex position, but it's the answer is 79s. That's the name of the... 79s, that's the name of the cantina.
That's 10 more.
They're going to go, call it 69. I could Google it and you can't call it that. I'll just call it 79 instead. Like, that was an editor's note, wasn't it?
Right. Anyway, so nearly that. Question 13: name a Jedi that was born on Coruscant.
I feel like you've been setting this up then with this whole Yaddle stuff.
No.
So I think in Legends, Obi-Wan was born on Coruscant because
I was going to say I used Obi-Wan. To have a.
Don't you always?
Yeah. Moan it.
When I was a kid, I had this DVD that was free with... The first part was free with a copy of The Sun, which meant that my mum actually had to buy The Sun, which was difficult. But and then the other one was with News of the World. And it was basically a video... it was a DVD narrated by Anthony Daniels about heroes and villains of Star Wars. And it used to give home planet and hair and eye color and all the Wikipedia stuff. And then it used to just talk. These just talk a little bit about it. I watched it a lot of times when Revenge of the Sith was coming out of hype. And then when it was finished, they had these little documentaries of like behind the scenes of Revenge of the Sith. But I thought it was Coruscant for Obi-Wan.
So is that your answer as well, Vaughn, or?
Well, I was going to say Obi-Wan, but then I feel like he was also, like, I feel like we got a little bit more about his history in Kenobi, and I don't remember him acknowledging that. He only acknowledged that he had a brother, and that implies that he was taken away, but that doesn't necessarily imply off-planet. So yeah, I'm
that's
gonna say
that's
Obi-Wan.
What I was thinking.
Yeah, I'm gonna say Obi-Wan.
Okay, so you are so close, yet so far. The answer is Qui-Gon Jinn. Obi-Wan's home world, both in Legends and canon, is Stujon. But in Legends, we didn't know Qui-Gon's home world, but in canon, it is confirmed to be Coruscant.
Interesting.
Anyway. The penultimate question. Name three tourist destinations on Coruscant that haven't already been mentioned.
Like at all in the episode or just in the quiz?
Let's say the quiz because I will not remember from
that one. It's hard to tell, but we started off the episode talking about wealth inequality and somehow we've ended up here.
Yeah. So there's Monument Plaza. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, I don't think we talked about that in the quiz, so yep.
Yeah. Steele mentioned the peak of the mountain in the quiz, I think. That we see in
We already covered the Palpatine gift shop in the hospital.
The Palpatine gift shop, of course.
Yeah, the Palpatine gift shop, where you can get Palpatine robes with little holes for the lightsaber that they can, so you can flick it out of your sleeve.
You can get little plush emperors that say "get well soon."
And if you buy one for your wife, then she'll miraculously come back from the dead.
Somehow. Jesus.
Oh, the opera.
Actually, there's.
The Opera House.
Yeah, good answer. So just the actual name of that is Galaxy's Opera House, but yeah, absolutely. Yep.
I also just remembered in the most recent episode of, not most recent, in the episode of Mandalorian set on Coruscant, I believe they mention a museum, and I cannot remember what I cannot remember what museum it is or what it's a museum of. It's not Palpatine in this case, but there is in the Lego show, The Freemaker Adventures, there's a Palpatine museum on Naboo, and it's amazing. There's little animatronic Palpatines that tell, like, direct people, but also just like in the Palpatine voice. So it's like, I'm afraid the restrooms are quite occupied. It's amazing.
So one more.
So are we still missing one then?
We are missing one.
Qui-Gon's home. I would want to visit Qui-Gon's home.
It's true.
You would.
I mean, wasn't that the Jedi Temple?
Was he born in the temple?
No, he wasn't born in the temple.
Yeah. Well, wherever he was born, I want to go to that spot. He looks enough like maybe Jesus. Like we can set up Christmas there.
Life day.
Always bringing it back to Christmas. I think we might be stuck. Do you want to just go with the answer?
Yeah, so so firstly, just to touch on what Steele was mentioning. So what's really cool is that in a book that I got quite recently, the illustrated Star Wars universe that I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, it mentions the Holographic Museum of Extinct Animals and the Sky Dome Botanical Gardens, which was really cool because those were also two places mentioned in the episode of The Mandalorian. Now, I do have a list of other answers, which I can give you if you want. It is a long list, a word of warning.
What are your favorite ones?
Those are probably my favorites, actually. But we do have a few others. Oh, actually, a big one that's very much part of the Federal District is Processional Way. Right outside, I think that's the one that's... that's the one that's right outside the Jedi Temple. And then we have the Avenue of the Four Founders, which is the sort of like the huge... avenue outside the Senate building or the Senate Rotunda. There's a few others that are mentioned elsewhere, you know, so like we have we do have like the Galactic Museum, but I think actually those two that were mentioned in Dandor probably were my favorites just because it just fleshes it out so well. I quite like it. Okay, anyway, so final question. Name a planet other than Coruscant, which is an Acumenopolis.
Ooh.
And I you talked about one earlier in the episode.
I googled the one from KOTOR. I googled it twice to get the name, and then I forgot it both times. The one from the one that's blown up in The Force Awakens isn't a city planet, is it? It's because it has vegetation, I believe. I can't remember what that's called. Is it Hosnian Prime? I can't remember.
I would just say that is correct. Hosnian Prime is an Acumenopolis.
Yeah! I can't remember what the one from KOTOR is called at all, I'm afraid.
So, the one from KOTOR is called Taris.
That's the one.
But there are a bunch of others as well. Some of these I didn't recognise when I was doing this, but others you will. So, we also have Denon, Euphornis Major, Troif, which is a really cool one, actually, that we see in the Alphabet Squadron trilogy of books featured in the second amazing series. We also have the planet Empress Teta. And then Nar Shaddaa is an Acumenopolis.
So
quite well known for being a hub of criminal activity for the entire galaxy. Just basically think the underworld of Coruscant, but it is now completely the entire planet. There's one which may be an error, so I'm not going to say it. And then lastly, we have one called Wind.
Wind. Yeah, I was trying to think if any of those are used in any visual media, or if they're all from Expanded. I love the idea of Nar Shaddaa. There's whole planets of sand, and whole planets of city, and whole planets of jungle, but this one's a whole planet of crime.
Yes.
Right, so that's all 15 questions.
It is indeed.
Daniel, thank you so much for those. As always... Vaughn and Steele did excellent, and I could barely say words, so well done to you guys.
You could say Yaddle.
I can say Yaddle, I can say Seven. I don't know what more is wanted from me. Right. Are we wanting to close up there, or is there any final thoughts from anyone? No, nothing from George to finish off the show. No. Okay.
Well, I just wanted to say once again, thank you very much for having me on. I mean, obviously, I love Vaughn and Steele as amazing friends, but also, sort of like a huge fan of the show. You know, I do the quizzes, but listen to every episode, and to actually be here in person, being part of it, is special. So thank you.
Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Daniel. It's been a real pleasure. Real pleasure having you on.
We love you too.
Yeah.
We say that every episode, that we love Daniel, but we hadn't said it yet today. So we love you, Daniel. Thank you for doing the quizzes. Thank you for being here for this episode.
You're welcome.
Absolutely. Right. I guess we should close up then. From Daniel, from Vaughn, from Steele, and from the creator himself. thank you very much for listening. And we'll have another episode for you at some point. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye.
Yaddle.
Thank you.